Transportation Committee will come to order, and we will start out with the first bill, which is going to be Senator Scheid. But before we start out, we have a very full agenda today, and we want to make sure that everyone is very concise and to the point with all of the comments. Thank you. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 412 is pretty straightforward. I think maybe all of the bills are that you're going to have today, and I have people here to talk about some of the history of this and certainly of the urgency, of the strong need to get this road completed. About a year ago, in a dreadfully snowy day, the governor joined us on what we affectionately, well, I shouldn't use the word affection, cynically called the Bridge to Nowhere. The Highway 610 is actually completed through the community where I live, and it's in Senator Foley's district, if you will, coming through Brooklyn Park. It goes all the way over to Highway 10 in Anoka County. And the idea is that it would connect to Interstate 94 out in Maple Grove. It is that piece between Brooklyn Park, the western end of Brooklyn Park, and 94, which is further to the west, through Maple Grove, that needs to be completed. We've been driving, I'll let somebody else, maybe the mayor can tell me how long we've had it going, but it has been a long road to get to this Bridge to Nowhere. It stops at Highway 169. If this were complete, you, I think, would not be hearing so many times on the radio. Virtually every morning you hear about the Fish Lake Interchange and other interchanges, a 494 connection, and that's in Maple Grove. And it's a dreadful situation. We would see so much relief, I think, if this were completed across the northern part of it would be running north of Highway 94, which goes through Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center, on an east-west direction. I've lived in Brooklyn Park since 1967. It wasn't long after that there was talk of having a highway cutting across, like the crosstown, although that's a sore subject for us in Brooklyn Park as well today. But we'll be talking to you about Devil's Triangle on Thursday. But I understand the needs, obviously, of what they have in the south side of town. But we've been trying to get a north crosstown for over 30 years. And what happened is that the cities did a lot of massive planning, preparing for this, acquiring right-of-way, establishing, I think it's called the Rolfe Fund, a revolving loan fund to help acquire right-of-way. I'd have to let Mayor of Maple Grove tell you if that's all acquired in Maple Grove, but I know we did it in Brooklyn Park well in advance of the completion of the highway through Brooklyn Park. There's just been enormous energy and effort and concern and time put in by a lot of organizations, including the North Metro mayors, as well as other people who have been so committed to seeing this completed. It is so important for the northwestern suburbs. It is important for economic development. I have someone here who is an investor, whose company is in developing some of this land. Some of you may know about the Target Corporation's decision to expand its headquarters, if you will. I don't know if I should call it headquarters, but expand its operation in northern Brooklyn Park. They already have a significant facility there. I think someday they look at having 30,000 jobs as part of that ultimate development. That's not online day one, but you can imagine the need then to get people to and from this area where there is all of this development going on. It's enormous, and right now it's at the bursting point, and I have with me Mayor of Maple Grove, Mark Stephenson, and we'll start with you, if that's all right.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Chairman Carlson and members of the committee. Mark Stephenson, the Mayor of Maple Grove. I'm also the Chair of the North Metro Crossing Coalition, a aggregation of communities and counties in the northern part of the cities that is supporting this expansion and 610. I'm also the president of the North Metro Mayors Association, a community of 22 cities across the northern metropolitan area. And the 610 project is the number one transportation project for the North Metro Mayors Association, that group of 22 cities. I think it's important for the committee to understand the background of Highway 610. Highway 610 is a road that was first conceived in the late 1940s by the communities as a North Crosstown project. It was put into the trunk highway system in the state in 1976. It was supposed to be completed shortly thereafter. In fact, an elementary school was specifically built on the north side of the soon-to-be-built 610 because of the concerns of elementary schools crossing the highway. Obviously, we sit here 31 years later, and the road is still not built. It is still not completed, and it's time to complete this project. This project has a huge and enormous impact for all the northwestern suburbs. As Senator Scheid mentioned, this road will not only impact the congestion that we see every single day of the week on I-94, 694, and 494, it'll also directly impact the current congestion that's on Highway 10 as it runs through Anoka. This is an alternate route across the northern metropolitan area that needs to be completed. Also, I'm just going to mention briefly the straight economic impacts and needs of this project for our community of Maple Grove, and I'll let Mayor Lampe address the issues for Brooklyn Park. As the members will recall, last year a new hospital was passed by this body and approved for the Maple Grove. This hospital is to be located on the edge of 610. This 610 will directly benefit and provide the direct access to the freeway system for this hospital. It's material needed for the hospital. This road needs to be completed for this north or west part of the metropolitan communities to effectively function, both from a business perspective and from a traffic congestion perspective. So with that, I know your time is limited today, so I will defer to Mayor Lampe with regards to the target projects and the other important projects as this relates to Brooklyn Park.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, excuse me, Mayor, I just want to see, Senator obviously Scheid. You see Senator Limmer is here, and he has a bill on the agenda as well, and I don't know if he wants to take the opportunity to say something as well, or
I'd like then to Mayor combine Lambert. Your comments. This would be Senate File 89 for Senator Limmer.
And the subject matter is identical.
Correct, yes.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chair and committee members. Coming in late, I could probably just say ditto and save us a lot of time, but
yes.
You all know that I'm not capable of that. But I did want to let you know that the two bills before you are definitely for the same purpose. My particular bill, Senate File 89, is to recognize a federal match fund that's available from the federal government. As you know, 20% would come from the state in the amount of $6 million. And the balance, roughly, of $29 million would come from the feds. We missed that opportunity last year. Some of the senior members would remember that the transportation bill kind of got waylaid in the conference committee. It was part of our Senate transportation bill coming out of the Senate last year. Matter of fact, there were three federal match projects that were available last year. I believe now it's expanded to five or six. But nevertheless, the one that we're talking about today is to help fund Highway 610 and grab the available federal funds that are being offered to us. Every time we get an opportunity to grab $29 million out of the feds, I think we should look very seriously at it and take advantage of it. And I'll pass the microphone over to Mayor from Brooklyn Park, and we can continue talking about this.
My community's mayor, Steve Lampe, is here.
Well, thank you. And
Mayor Lampe.
Thank you, Chairman Carlson and members of the committee. My name is Steve Lampe, and I am the mayor of Brooklyn Park. Brooklyn Park is, as Senator Scheid indicated, the spot where you see the road end. You can stand on the top of the bridge, and you can look at a field where the road is supposed to be. You can see where the...
Excuse me for 1 second. Could you move the mic just a bit closer?
I'm sorry. Is that better?
A little closer.
Is that better?
That's better.
Yes.
Okay. Very good.
Mayor Lampe.
Brooklyn Park is a spot where you can stand on the bridge and look at the field where the road is supposed to go, and it's not completed. It's just such an impact, I think, on our city. As Senator Scheid mentioned, we got the Target Corporation that'll be moving, adding to its facility in our city. They've purchased 335 acres of land. They're anticipating building a development that will equal somewhere in the neighborhood of about 8 million square feet of office space, 2 million square feet of retail space, and 3,000 housing units in that parcel. They anticipate somewhere in the neighborhood of about 30,000 jobs in that specific development. But in addition to that, we will probably have an additional 23,000 jobs that will be created by companies that want to support and locate around that facility. And this corridor is really, Mayor Stephenson mentioned, it will run from Maple Grove all the way through Mounds View, so it's going to connect the new North Memorial Hospital, Target Corporation, and Medtronic on the other end. So it's not just a Maple Grove issue, it's not a Brooklyn Park issue, it's an issue for the whole region. I think that in addition to the Target Corporation, we've done some land use changes and some in Brooklyn Park that's going to allow for some significantly higher density development along the 610 corridor. And once again, it's going to be very crucial that that facility, infrastructure is completed. So with that, I think if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But otherwise, I'll turn it back to Senator Scheid.
Senator Scheid.
And Mr. Chairman and members, Mr. Lally would like to say a few words as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Lally, and I represent Hoyt Properties. We have approximately 91 acres at the southwest quadrant of 169 and 610. And there's approximately somewhere between 650 or 700 acres along that 610 corridor that are waiting to be developed once that infrastructure is in place. And it's really stalled right now until we can get access to that freeway. And because a developer is not going to want to do any development and then have it have the access cut off while they're building the road system. So it's kind of the chicken and the egg thing. So I'd encourage you to look very favorably on the extension of this road.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the picture that's on the top of the handout here, you mentioned that where the corridor is, there's an awful lot of rather thick development that's just beyond the where it currently ends between there and 94. Has there, in fact, been land preserved? Because I can't see it on this photo.
I can answer that question, Mr. Chairman Carlson, Senator Olson. The land is acquired. There is a right-of-way that follows a set of power lines through that area, and that right-of-way was acquired back in the 1970s and has been preserved. And so those homes that you see there were all, in fact, built in the 1970s, and the right-of-way for 610 actually runs right through the middle of those neighborhoods and connects. If you look on that map, as you look straight ahead, that road goes straight ahead over to that diagonal road, which is County Road 81, where some of the work for 610 is done, and then it diagonals across Maple Grove over to 94 from there. So all of the right-of-way, essentially from the east side of the 610, 169, has been acquired essentially over to the interchange at I-94. There are some parcels right around the interchange of I-94 that have not been acquired yet, but the city obviously has had numerous discussions with those individuals, and that land is ready to be acquired and ready to be developed.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to also speak on behalf of this bill. I represent, one of the cities I represent is Plymouth, and I know it would mean a lot to the people in Plymouth to have this road finished, as well as I know that they use this road going to and from many places. So thank you.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I want to add that it strikes me that some folks might be concerned about urban sprawl, and we're talking about development. Brooklyn Park is only a second-ring suburb, and yet we still have development, significant development to be done in the northern half of our city. Likewise, Maple Grove. I guess, are you third? Could you be second?
I don't know if they're second.
I'm trying. You have to look at a map. You could be almost a second. You're third. A third ring, but they also have a lot of room for development, and they've had some wonderful development that's happened there. I spend a lot of my time and even more of my money in Maple Grove. they have wonderful retail, and and so I just, both of these communities have been well planned and well thought out, and have, as you see, have been ready for this highway for a long time, and not just in theory, but in fact in acquiring right-of-way and being ready. We do need the dollars to get it finished. And so with that, I...
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last point that I might want to make sure that the committee realizes is that if you recognize the Met Council's population projection for the metropolitan area, roughly in 12 to 15 years, we'll start feeling an impact of close to 1 million more people living in the Twin City area. That makes this road completion that much more critical, especially when you know that there's an emergency hospital right in the center of its path going across Hennepin County. That hospital was designed to serve the people not only in the immediate area, but the surrounding area and up that Highway 94 corridor. If you look at the if you're familiar where the intersection of 94, 494, and 694 come together in Maple Grove and took that point and went up the freeway to Rogers, it's only 11 miles. In the last 11 years, we've had over 2,200 accidents due to congestion problems on Highway 94 and, sadly, 24 deaths. So the problem of having on that road over 120,000 vehicles a day drive through Maple Grove gives you a little idea of how critical this is to getting 610 completed as soon as we can in order to make it a safe area to travel in, but also give critical access of speed and emergency vehicles to that hospital when there is that type of a problem. So there's a number of reasons why, but we're recognizing the future population growth as well as getting it done in time so that we have a road ready for that population when it comes to this region.
Do you have the feel for where this sets in MnDOT's plans? MnDOT has committed that they don't want to lose any federal funds.
The minor stay is that in the metropolitan.
Mayor Stephenson.
Chairman Carlson. Minor stay is that in the metropolitan area that this is one of the three priority projects that MnDOT recognizes for the Metropolitan District. The three projects, I believe, are the Devil's Triangle, 610, and then the interchange at 169 and 494 in Bloomington. I think those are the next three priority projects, and I don't know the exact order, but I think 610 is the number one priority of those three projects.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I need just a clarification, because on the back page of the handout it says estimated costs are $211 million. And as I add up the requests, that doesn't seem to be enough. So is there another funding stream?
Just Mr. Chairman, if I might, is that handout the one? Did you have that?
I don't have the other one. I guess I'm not sure which handout you're referencing.
Okay. So. Well, on the back page it said projected cost for completing the 610 is $211 million. And as I add up the $150 million request, unless there's I'm just wondering what is the proper amount?
There are certain federal funds that are currently, Senator, there are certain federal funds that are already available for this project that were obtained through the appropriations and the authorizations that are currently outstanding of about $35 million that have to be, that are designated to be used for this project. And my understanding that, I'm not sure, there might be a small difference because there's been an increase in the estimate of the cost of the acquisition of the remaining right of way.
Okay. Senator Olteen, follow up.
Well, this $150 million number, is that for, is there a match to that, or is that the portion that's being matched?
In addition to, go ahead.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olseen, the only federal match that is available to us at this time is the one that's embodied in Senate File 89. That, the numbers on that is for $6 million of state funds, the federal government would provide close to $29 million, totaling roughly $35 million in total. That's the only federal match that we know for this particular road at this time.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Any further questions from the audience, or would anyone like to testify pro or con? I'm sorry, Senator Dibble.
You can finish your call for testimony. I just had a comment. Well, I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, an earlier point that Senator Scheid made, we're going to try. I was looking at some of the future and current development up there, and definitely we need to finish this road. I completely agree. I don't actually think this road would necessarily serve all the demand that some of, the 30,000 jobs at the Target campus and the Fairview Hospital and all of that. So we're going to do our darndest in the Transit Subcommittee and then this larger committee to also provide some transit alternatives, because I'm honestly, with 30,000 jobs and however many other jobs and the new residences and the like that are going up there, this project won't be adequate to the task. So,
and Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, just in response to Senator Dibble, I appreciate that. And Senator Dibble and Representative Hornstein had a meeting at Brooklyn Park City Hall a few Saturdays ago, very highly attended. And what I think you saw the commitment of our neck of the woods to transit, mm-hmm. and what the hopes and the plans are for that in our area. You're right. The road won't do it all.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I did take the opportunity to drive back on Botineau Boulevard, and Commissioner Opat was right. It is ripe for a facility like that. It's well tailored for and it cries out for that need.
Comment, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, a question. I'm looking at this right-of-way map in this brochure, and there's nothing labeled, so I can't tell exactly what it was, but I think this is the right-of-way that is that you were talking about that has been preserved. And then we get over to this business that looks like is that a merger with 81 or Botineau Boulevard that looks about as complicated as the 35 and Crosstown current mess that we have? You're not creating one of those, are you?
No, we're Mr. Chairman Carlson, Senator Olson. That
Mayor
is
Stephenson.
Actually the new design for the combination of Highway 81 and 610 in this area, where you actually end up with 610 crossing over and ending up on parallel sides of Highway 81 at one time. And it actually, I think, will work, but it is in place now, and actually this part of the road has actually been constructed.
What happened?
81 has been moved, and the old roadbed for 81 has been transformed into what will be the new roadbed for 610, and this was able to be done from previous federal authorization dollars from, I believe, the ICE-T or the T-LU project from 1989.
So, Mr. Chairman, is this road done to 81 then?
Mr. Chairman and Senator,
Mayor Stephenson.
The road is not done to 81. They've only done, pursuant to MnDOT's plans, this area was going to take several years to construct, and there were some large power lines that had to be moved at the same time. And so the decision was made back in the late 1990s that with the additional federal funds that this little half-mile section of road or mile section of road would be constructed first, and then the remaining portions would be left unconstructed for further appropriations or authorizations in the future.
Thank you.
The hospital. Mr. Chairman, if we might show where the hospital
Senator Scheid.
Will be. Mayor, Senator Olson might want to
If you would turn to the next page of the brochure,
Mayor
I
Stephens.
Think that the next page of the brochure not only shows where the target facilities are located, but also shows where the new North Memorial Hospital site is, the new Fairview Clinic site. The new North Memorial Clinic site is next to the hospital as well, so it shows sort of for the committee where those roads are. One thing that I would note is that that red road that's being built that's indicated is Maple Grove Parkway that the city is currently building as we speak, so that that road will actually be ready to open in the middle of the summer.
Chairman, thank you very much for your time.
Senator Scheid, thank you very much. And with that, at this point, we will lay Senate File 412 on the table for possible inclusion in another, in a larger bill. And we'll also lay over Senate File 89 for possible inclusion in a larger bill. Thank you very much, testifier.
Thank you
very much.
So we got two.
Our next bill will be Senate File 391. Senator Metzen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
That's press. Yeah, 391. Senator Metzen.
This, Mr. Chair and members, deals with an interchange on Highway 55 at Yankee Doodle Road in northern Dakota County. What happened a couple of years ago, the Metro Council opened up a Musa line with water and sewer out to over 3,000 acres in northern Dakota County in Inver Grove Heights. What's going to happen if this is approved? There will be about $1 billion tax base created in this area. And this is maybe about three blocks from the Thompson West 500,000 square foot addition announcement that you've all heard about. The governor is promoting that one too. This will create $450 million in the tax base in northern Dakota County and Inver Grove Heights. Talking about 5,400 new households in the region, in the area, and I could have the developers come up here and tell you, if they will, who the potential investors are in this region. I mean, we're talking about 1,000 permanent jobs once it's completed, and about the same number of jobs to build a project out here. But without the intersection, this economic development area will not, in my opinion, happen. But I'd like to have you look at, I guess we don't have it numbered, but it'd be about page three. You take a look at the region and where it's at, the proximity to St. Paul, Minneapolis, proximity to the airport. And then if you go another page, you can see a more Northwest Airlines office complex, Eco Lab. The Postal Service headquarters for the Twin Cities, UPS, and you can only imagine the need for this intersection in this region. You can look at the density of the subject area on the next page. Shows that there's room to grow out here, and but without, again, I repeat, the backing of or without the expansion of this intersection, it's probably not going to happen for a long time. We've got the Northern Dakota County Chamber, Gopher Resource, City of Eagan, City of Inver Grove Heights, all on board. And again, I repeat, this will create 1,000 permanent jobs. It's not only a highway construction matter, it's an economic development issue. And would really open up this region. So what's really the trigger in this is the sewer and water expansion to the 3,000 acres. I have a couple of the developers here, Chuck Hall and Steve Schmidt, that might want to add. I know you're in a time crunch here, and we're not going to take as long as the first group, and maybe that'll help our situation. We can move a little faster. But with that, I might have a couple of these guys come up and briefly go a little further than I did. But this is really quite a project for the region, and it's very important to Minnesota, not only the area out there, but it's kind of the gateway to St. Paul, Minneapolis, and kind of the crossroads out there. So did you
guys? Yes, Senator Mintz said we can have some brief con.
Yeah, we've got Mr. Chuck Hall to my left, Mr. Steve Schmidt at the end, and our city manager, Joel Lynch. So with that, they could give brief remarks with your permission.
Yeah, we have a question from Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Metzen, do you know where this project is on the MnDOT priority list? Is it included in the governor's project or bill?
Yeah, this is, to be frank, it's not on there yet.
Senator
and the
Metzen.
Reason I think it's not on there is because I believe it was just within the last year or so that the need was created with the sewer and water connecting out there. I mean,
okay.
Without that, you've got nothing, not much could happen here on this intersection. So maybe it'll get on the next one. But
okay.
That's why I think it's probably not quite on the radar screen yet. But
thank you.
Senator Metzen, you will introduce.
Yeah, Mr. Hall might give you a couple words. I don't know if he could tell you who might be coming out to the region or what, or maybe that's confidential, but give him a little two-minute speech there, Mr. Hall.
Please identify yourself for the record, Mr. Hall.
My name is Chuck Hall.
Real close to the mic.
Better turn it on. My name is Chuck Hall. I am a real estate developer in the Twin Cities for 55 years. Resident of Invergrove Heights for 5 and resident of Eagan for 50. And I've worked this area for the last 3 to 5 years. Are you still here? For the last 3 to 5 years in watching this area develop and consulting with the city of Eagan and the city of Invergrove Heights on the necessary infrastructure. This particular key interchange, I've driven it for 55 years. Two friends of mine were killed there. It's been a bottleneck for a long time. It's not on the Dakota County's radar screen or the state until the development became apparent and available, as Senator Metzen said, by the provision of the city water and sewer in the area. As he showed on that map, this is a close-in suburb. We're so close to downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul that we're 10 minutes away. So we will fill in. Developers are standing by. One of them is in the audience, McGuff Construction Company, which most of you might be familiar with. They're awaiting permit for construction right now. And 4 other developers are standing by waiting for the completion of the zoning ordinance necessary by the new AUAR put in by Invergrove Heights.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Hall is one of the long-term people in Eagan, as am I. And he said 55 years in Eagan?
Right. We watched Eagan grow pretty well.
We sure did, yes. Thank you. Next testifier, please state your name for the record.
Senator Carlson, my name is Stephen Schmidt, and I'm also a resident of Eagan. I also happen to be a property owner that is affected by this in Invergrove Heights. And I've owned that property for 30 years. And frankly, it wasn't until this year that the city of Invergrove Heights gave all of the approvals to go ahead and to extend sewer and water that is going to open up the 3,000 acres that Senator Metzen discussed that is going to make it possible for this commercial retail development to occur, for which McGuff is in the audience and could speak to, but given the brevity of time available, we won't ask them to do so. But there will be many homes in that 3,000-acre area just in Invergrove Heights. Additionally, you have the development taking place in Eagan with the Yankee Doodle, which has already been extended and stops right at this intersection with the temporary hanging traffic light over this intersection. And now with the development that's going to take place between Robert Street and Argenta, that traffic is going to loop through there, and it's going to come down to 63 and have no place to go because it's going to be bottlenecked right at that intersection. I'd be glad to answer any other questions. Just wanted to emphasize the importance. Thank you.
Do you want to just say that support of Denver Grove Heights?
Senator Metzen?
Yeah.
You have another testifier?
Pardon?
You have another testifier?
Yeah, Mr. Lynch is our city administrator from Denver Grove Heights, and he can probably speak to the little bit about the project, but mostly about the great support of the chamber and the mayor and the council out in Northern Dakota County.
Mr. Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing us this opportunity. I am here representing Mayor George Torvill, who couldn't be here this evening, who's been involved in this process and project for a long time. In 2006, the city of Denver Grove Heights did pass a resolution in support of this interchange and continues to support it. As was mentioned previously, we have gone ahead looking at design plans for extension of sewer and water to this area, which could open up between 5,000 and 6,000 new units, housing units in this area, and the traffic necessitates the solution. Thank you.
Barry, did you want to say something? We have quickly Barry Tilley from the Dakota County.
Senator represents.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Dakota County Board of Commissioners, and I would like to just state on behalf of the county board that we are supportive of this project. We don't have a funding source identified for this. We have four other projects that are similar projects in our CIP, which we have found funding sources for. MnDOT hasn't found a funding source for their portion, and which is why Senator Metzen has to come forward with this bill, because MnDOT doesn't have enough money. The last three interchanges built in Dakota County on trunk highways, the city of Lakeville forwarded the state share for one of those. Dakota County forwarded the state share for the other two, because MnDOT doesn't have the money. Hopefully we can get enough money out of a transportation funding bill this year to pay for this intersection and a bunch of others that we have pending. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Tilley.
Thank you. Yeah, that was very good.
Senator Metzen.
No,
we have a question from Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzen, question about some of the property owners that might live in that area. How is there any issues with buying that property with some of the folks that live in that area?
Yeah, I'll let the developers kind of visit that, but it's been pretty good with the council. There's not been really any opposition that I'm aware of. And I went to a couple of the meetings, and I didn't see any. You talk about the neighborhood?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of still wide open, pretty wide open out there because of the lack of sewer and water. But once this gets done, this thing's going to.
Right on, excuse
Senator
Mr. Chair, on that interchange there, I know there's some older buildings, some older homesteads. Have the dealings been, like I say, fairly fair? Are they using eminent domain to purchase that land, or is there the dealings been taken care of outside of that?
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman and members, this particular interchange only involves one homestead, and we've been in discussion with that, and more than likely the developer will acquire that for the state.
I'm sorry, I
no
couldn't hear that.
Senator Dahl.
We don't think there's any condemnation necessary. There's only one homestead involved, and the developers have been in contact with that homestead person, and if necessary, we'll do the acquisition.
Okay. Thank you.
Neighbors appear at the council meeting opposed to it. Anybody?
Senator Metzen.
I don't think there is. The neighborhood is fine as far as I know on the meetings I've attended and the people I've talked to. So that hopefully hasn't been an issue, and we don't think it will be.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Metzen. So but for the funding problem, everything's sort of in order and ready to go.
Yeah, that's correct. Again, I say this is about a 600,000 or 700,000 square foot development, producing millions of dollars in taxes going forward. Sewer and water, everything's in place except for the energy. And another big reason for this is the West Publishing right out there. That how many millions of dollar addition is that going to be? And that
in excess
those
of
people
100.
Will be going through. Most of them will be going through this region or this intersection. So. There'll be a lot of people killed out here if we don't address it.
Senator Metzen, I have a question for you. This is called a folded diamond interchange. What was the purpose, or what was the briefly the thinking that went through to not make it a full cloverleaf interchange without left turns?
We like folding diamonds. I don't know why, but we'll let the engineers or the developers talk
about that. I'll take that one.
Mr. Hall.
The folded diamond is introduced by the city of Inver Grove Heights engineer when they talked with the city and the county and the state over the weaving problem that you have on interchanges. This one happens to be shorter than the one up at I-49 and 194, but it will take some innovative engineering between the state's engineers and the county engineers and the city engineers, and the closest thing we can think to that we have been advised by private engineers is that folded diamond will work. The other way, it's going to be too close to Robert Street Interchange, and there might have to be some adjustments made. We've done that research with the private engineers, and we've exposed it to the state. But the state doesn't have it on their agenda yet because they don't have any money. So we've been doing some of that engineering privately. We believe that's the reason for the folded diamond versus the other way. If we go without a folded diamond, then we can't serve Egan. And the minute you can't serve Egan, you lose their support because they need to get those people in over to Thompson and Ecolabs and Northwest and the rest of them. Yeah, speaking for Egan's mayor, but they're not here. They were busy this morning with you people working on their tax situation.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Oh, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Metzen. I guess as we go through some of this, maybe I'm the only guy that's going to ask the hard question, but I don't have any bill for appropriation, and I happen to sit in my district on the number one rated highway last year in terms of death and property damage. And you would just kind of, I guess we'd all assume that when they get that high that somehow we should fund them and MnDOT would take care of them, but it doesn't seem to happen that way. So I guess we need a little direction and help here. It seems like you want the intersection fixed for some new development because city sewer and water has been approved. And I think as we go through some of these things, we need to figure out, and I think that's one of the things that this transportation committee should be key in redirecting, is how do we figure out when a highway or an intersection or something should be funded. I think that's something we got to keep in mind, so I wanted to kind of interject that here. And but it's a big problem. We know we need the money to fund a great deal of projects, but I think we got to focus in on, you know, where, what should we put to our priority this year and keep on and maybe come up with a new framework. If we're not thinking MnDOT's doing that framework correctly, then I think it's our responsibility to maybe redirect MnDOT to that framework. And I think Senator Murphy's alluded to that. But so I'm not trying to kill your project, Senator Metzen, but I think we need to look at that, members, as to how do we elevate these projects.
Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, I think that's Senator absolutely Metzen. Correct. But having said what you said, I think Senator Murphy has given me the kind of the opinion that let's look at some of these on an individual basis. And if some surface come to the top, we are the legislature. We can make some decisions around here, too. Gosh darn it. You know, we're elected to make some calls. And this, I got out of Senator Murphy, and he can speak for himself. He usually does, but he's good at that. But I think he wanted to bring some of these projects in just to look at the merits on an individual basis. And we think ours, all people think theirs are pretty good, but this is not just an intersection. This is thousands of jobs, construction hour jobs, 1,000 permanent jobs. And it's like somebody, Steve said over here, it's 7 minutes from the airport, 7 minutes from downtown St. Paul and Minneapolis, and it's just a natural. And we could get to Owatonna from here. Rochester, no. But, no, I think that's what Senator Murphy had in mind, take some on an individual basis and look at them.
Senator Jungbauer, real quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Metzen, and I think this is a great conversation. And, you know, we hear about earmarking and things, and MnDOT always tells us, well, we don't like to do that, but I think, by gosh, something's got to change here. And if it means we got to earmark specific projects based on specific criteria and we got to legislatively direct it, and I'm full steam ahead on that because I'm getting tired of doing it the way we're doing it. But you're right. we need to keep on moving these roads as we get out into, you know, first ring, second ring, third ring. We need to do it in an orderly fashion so the development does happen the way it should happen. So that's one of the criteria as well. So thanks.
Senator Larson, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we move on, and I know we have a full agenda, but I think that Senator Jungbauer makes an excellent point. I mean, I think we have to get to the issue of finding a better funding stream so that we have all of the projects that we're having back up. We heard testimony in the Tax Committee this morning. Whether you support the Thompson West proposal or not on Senator Carlson's bill, that demonstrated that the city of Eagan is in fact picking up costs on the state highway that otherwise MnDOT would be covering, and it's because there's not enough money, and the city of Eagan has decided it cannot wait. And so it seems to me that really messes up our priorities. So I agree with Senator Jungbauer, and I know we have a full agenda. So
thank you, Senator Larson. That is the story we're hearing over and over, that cities and counties are picking up state projects.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Benson. And with that, we will lay Senate File 391 on the table for inclusion in a larger transportation bill. Possible inclusion in a larger transportation bill. The next bill we'll take up is Senator Bonhoff, Senate File 866. We are moving slightly out of order here simply to take into account some people's other commitments. But we will try to move real fast through this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I have with me Chief Goldstein, who will also be addressing the committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill asking for $100,000 to be appropriated to complete the installation of cable median barriers on Trunk Highway 490, or Interstate Highway 494, from the intersection of Carlson Parkway in the city of Plymouth to Highway 55. And just as background, this is a highway that was finished, the portion from 169 or from 494 all the way up to 394. It's been a wonderful addition for the community, and we're very pleased with this highway. Cable median barrier was supposed to have been installed all along this section, and there was due to a lack of funds, a portion did not get installed, and we have had dire consequences as a part of this. So this bill, while I know this, it is in the plans, this bill says that no matter what, this will happen in the immediate future. And before I say anything more, I'll let Chief Goldstein talk about
Senator
it.
Senator Bonhoff, thank you. Good afternoon,
Chief
Mr.
Goldstein.
Chair, committee members, thank you very much. My name is Mike Goldstein. I'm the police chief with the city of Plymouth, and I thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. When I was named police chief 3 years ago in the same community where I have served as a police officer since 1990, one of my top priorities was to address the amount of traffic crashes that our community has endured year after year. With that, I launched an aggressive traffic enforcement and educational campaign. One of the main objectives was to ask both MnDOT and the state legislature to approve the construction of cable median barriers along 6 miles of I-494 and along 4 miles of Highway 169, where vehicles routinely exceed the speed limit, traveling over 70 miles an hour with extremely narrow medians. In some areas, the width of the medians are less than one traffic lane, and it was our hope to reduce and preferably eliminate cross-through median crashes with the median barriers. Using 2004 statistics over the last decade on 494 alone, within just the city of Plymouth, there have been 11 significant cross-through median crashes that have resulted in 14 life-threatening injuries and 10 deaths. This does not include the dozens upon dozens of cross-through median crashes involving less significant injuries and property damage. With no scheduled improvements for these two highways within the city of Plymouth, our request was answered in 2006 when MnDOT erected cable median barriers along the requested portion on 169 and on a portion of the section on 494. While we are grateful for this response, more needs to be done. The original intent was to have the full length of I-494 covered by the barrier. In essence, basically from the Fish Lake interchange up in Maple Grove all the way down to 394 in Minnetonka. The intent was not completely met, and certain segments along 494 remain without the barrier. Unfortunately, this has led to disastrous results. The segment along I-494 that was covered by the barrier was completed in mid-October of 2006, several months later than we had anticipated. On October 31st, 2006, about 10 days after the project was complete, at approximately 8 p.m., a mother of four lost her life when a teenage motorist lost control of his vehicle while driving through the median and striking this unsuspecting motorist. How many more do we have to respond to? I have been there more times than I care to remember, dealing with the carnage and the aftermath and dealing with the families and trying to console them once they've lost loved ones. Thankfully, I have received written notice from Tom O'Keefe from MnDOT on February 1st, 2007, that the rest of this project will finally be completed. I have also received a written communique from Representative Sarah Anderson, who spoke with Eric Rudin from MnDOT, indicating the same. I am encouraging that you see that the funding for this project be properly appropriated to eliminate any future serious crashes. And with that, I stand for any questions and thank you for your time.
Are there any questions from the committee? Anyone? What do you, Senator? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. I just wanted, Police Chief, I think you just said that they're going to complete the construction, so then, or they're going to install the barriers, but is it that, Senator Bonoff, you still need the money to do it then?
Senator Sieben.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is supposed to be done this summer. This already had been promised to us before, and it didn't happen because there wasn't the money. So really this bill, and by the way, when I first drafted this legislation, I hadn't yet gotten word from MnDOT that it was going to be done, so I could have just withdrawn this based on their assuring us that it would be done. But I thought it was important for the record that that this be entered and that it publicly be confirmed that this would be done. So this should be already in the appropriation that MnDOT is planning on.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bonoff. And I guess I would just like to add that this
Senator
goes
Sieben.
Back to Senator Larson's point about how we're the inability of the state government to adequately fund MnDOT is having drastic consequences on many areas of the state, not only for mitigation of congestion, but also for safety issues. In my area, on Trunk Highway 61, there's a need for some median barriers where there have recently been two fatalities right around the Hastings Bridge, and MnDOT has said they're not sure if they have the money to put up those barriers. So thank you for bringing this bill forward, and again, it just speaks to the need to have a more comprehensive transportation funding package pass this session.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Any other comments? Anyone from the audience wish to speak on behalf of this bill? Senator Bonoff, we will lay over your bill, which is Senate File 866 for possible inclusion in a larger transportation bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next bill will be Senator Saxhog, Senate File 470. Senator Saxhog, I believe you have an amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment I'd like to have moved.
Thank you.
The A1 amendment.
We're passing out the amendment as we speak here.
Has the amendment been moved, Mr. Chair?
It has not been moved yet.
I'd move the amendment for the author.
Senator Larson moves the amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Same sign. The amendment is adopted. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 470 is amended, is a change to a law that was passed in 2005 that will allow a commodities corridor from Grand Rapids to the Port of Duluth. This bill, as amended, will allow the Blandin Paper Company to transport finished product to Duluth using new MnDOT-specified trucks along an already approved route. I would like to say that UPM Blandin, they're a global wood products manufacturer, major employer in Grand Rapids and Itasca County up in the wood basket, and they're an excellent corporate citizen. Today I have with me Joe Maher, Senior Vice President of UPM and General Manager of Blandin Paper, to my right, and Tom Pitts, Mill Logistics Operations Manager for Blandin, and they'll give some brief testimony.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joe Maher. I'm the Senior Vice President of UPM. And thank you, Senator
Saxog. Mr. Maher.
As the Senator mentioned, the Blandin Mill in Grand Rapids is owned by UPM. UPM is a very large global forest products company, and as such is able to invest money in pretty much any continent of the world. Right now, we're competing quite hard for a project, and one of the key criteria that is being evaluated are logistics costs. Unfortunately for Grand Rapids, we're served by only one railroad, and we are not able to get competitive rail rates out of just one railroad. Our solution has been to truck paper to Duluth. In Duluth, there are four Class I railroads that we can negotiate with, and we have been able to get much better rail rates by doing that. As mentioned, in 2005, there was a law passed by the legislature that allowed for heavier weight trucks between Grand Rapids and Duluth. That law permits the heavier trucks in the event that Blandin does secure the building permits for a new paper machine. And I'd like to thank the legislature and in particular this committee for that law. That's a very important message back to the mothership in Helsinki, that Minnesota is open for business and is anxious for investment. Several things have happened since 2005. Most notably, rail rates have continued to escalate, I think somewhere around 50% in the last 2 years. 50%. We've also worked quite hard with the city of Duluth to finalize what the final route would be through the city once the commodity corridor goes into effect. Our aim is to get down to the port with the safest and most efficient way. And the Minnesota DOT has completed a technical study with the aid of the University of Michigan on heavier weight trucks. As a result of these three things, the amended Senate File 470 is asking for three things. Number one, that Blandin be able to start using the corridor now rather than waiting for the permits, the building permits to come through. Secondly, we'd like to add a short stretch of existing Trunk Highway 194 that helps match up the corridor with the preferred route through Duluth. And thirdly, we'd like to add a third truck option that was not in the original bill, and that's a 7-axle, 97,000-pound truck that came out of the technical study. And we find that a very intriguing option for us. So with that, thank you for your time, and I hope we have your support.
Thank you, Mr. Maher.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask Mr.
Senator
Pitts.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ask Mr. Pitts to comment on working with the different stakeholders along the highway.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record. Pull your mic up close and be very brief, please.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Pitts. I'm the Mill Logistics Operations Manager at Blandin Paper Company in Grand Rapids. And I've personally been working with communities along the route over the last 3 years just to keep them informed, get approval where necessary. The city of Duluth has approved a route off from Highway 2, the final leg of the delivery, if you will, into the Port of Duluth, and we're just looking for some adjustments here so that we can accommodate the wishes of the city of Duluth. Thank you.
Anyone from MnDOT like to comment on the proposal? Ms. Parker, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I will be very brief and just say that the department is very familiar with the proposal and has been working with Blandon and fully supports the proposed legislation.
Thank you very much. Any comments from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Saxhog, if I misunderstood, you wanted to move this forward, the permits a little bit quicker, and I was under the understanding that you were going to specially build new vehicles to meet these requirements. Is that correct? Or is that...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I'm going to ask Mr. Maher to comment on that.
Yes, Senator, that's true. The permits that we're talking about initially that need to be approved for the paper machine to be built are still in the works. But if we are able to go ahead and start using the corridor today, we would be able to purchase new vehicles that would match the specifications set out by MnDOT. Am I answering the right
question?
To a degree,
Mr. Chair. I guess then the weight distribution that we were talking about is not going to be met at this point then until you get those new trucks. Is that correct? And we'll be putting them on this road prior or for some time then until you're able to purchase the new vehicles. Is that correct?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, today we are transporting approximately 27 loads per week on conventional 80,000-pound five-axle trucks, as the law allows. And that's expected to go up probably next month to around 50 loads per week. And what we're asking for is, with this change in the legislation, to be able to go to the heavier weight truck with more axles, but we'd have no intention of doing any of that until the legislation is fixed to be able to allow us to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Maher. Mr. Maher. Senator Mwah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Maher, and if you've said this already, I apologize, I didn't hear. Has the building permit for the construction of the new pulp and paper company facility in Grand Rapids been issued already?
Mr. Maher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, there are many, many permits required to build a $700-800 million paper machine expansion. So far, we have the air permit in place. We are waiting on, actually, the city of Grand Rapids is still working on the waste treatment plant permit. That's getting close. All that being said, I should say, though, that we do not have a commitment yet from the company that the project is funded at this point. We've completed our feasibility study, and when all the permits are in hand, the company will look at market conditions and world demand for paper before deciding whether to make a decision or not. So to answer your question, no, the permits are not in hand yet.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Mwah.
Mr. Maher and Senator Saxhog, I guess my sense was that one of the reasons why we tied the effective date, make it contingent, was so that we could get some help or give you some help in trying to make sure that we somehow are able to get a facility in Grand Rapids. And so I'm a little bit, not necessarily concerned, but I'm a little bit disconcerted that if we remove the contingency, would that would that help or harm our effort to try to get the paper company, I guess, committed to staying there?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sock-Sock.
Senator Ma, I think that in answer to your question, and I understand it perfectly, I think one of our problems here is Mr. Maher said in the beginning, is that we've seen transportation rates for railroads go up dramatically in the last year. And to remain if all things being the same, I think what you said, the fact that we don't have the hammer, so to speak, might hold some water. But I think right now it's very important that we stay competitive, and I'm confident that we're dealing with UPM in confidence.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions from the committee? With that, Senator Olsen moves that. Where is it? Senate File 470, as amended, be passed and sent to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Thank you,
Thank
Senator
you, Mr. Sackler. Chair, members.
Thank you.
We will take up Senate File 107, Senator Wieger. Senator Wieger, we are behind schedule. We need to go very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 107 seeks an appropriation of $2 million for bridge replacement design. The Rice Street Bridge at Highway 36, about 4 miles north of here, at the communities adjacent would be Roseville, Maplewood, Little Canada. The state has recognized the intent to replace this bridge, but not until 2024. Right now, it is rated an F by Ramsey County engineers. It is dangerous. There's also increased activity with the planned expansion of St. Jude Medical. They're looking at substantial expansion, in fact, of over 300 to 400 jobs, and hoping that this would help and allay one of the concerns. And so there's plenty of people that could testify on it. There's a need. It's been documented by various sources, and I would stand for questions or bring witnesses in deference to your timetable. Appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Would you want your guest to testify?
Mr. Chair, if you need testimony.
Any questions from anyone on the committee? Well, with that, we would like to lay over Senate File 107 for possible inclusion in a larger transportation bill. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
We didn't vote on that. Next bill is Senate File 8, Senator Betzold. And same comments, Senator Betzold, if you can be quite succinct.
We will do what we can. Mr. Chair, is there an A1 amendment?
Yes. We have an amendment, yes.
If that could be adopted as an author's amendment to put the bill in shape, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I move the amendment.
Senator Larson moves the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, this is a issue that's been before this committee before. This deals with a sound wall in the city of Moundsview along Highway 10. Many years ago, before Highway 10 became what it the busy road that it is, a partial sound wall was built to cover a lot of the area, but not one residential area. Ultimately, Highway 10 has the volume has expanded considerably as it goes off of 35W and leads into 610, which I believe you heard from Senator Limmer a little earlier. So the volume is considerable, and there's a neighborhood that sits right there on it without any protection from the sound wall. To further worsen the situation, right across the street had been some land that had been used for recreational purposes. That land is part of the land has been sold to Medtronic, and there's a beautiful campus that's being built there. However, the traffic is, situation is now causing the noise levels to go up considerably because it's bouncing off the walls right into the neighborhood. And actually, MnDOT got $1 million because of a land transfer that occurred with that. So we do hope that committee will consider this favorably, the fact that this has been around for quite a few years, and we're working with MnDOT to try to find a resolution to this. I do have some members here who are giving brief testimony, and I've cautioned them to be brief. Joe Flaherty from the Mountain View City Council, Dick Swanson from the North I-35 Coalition, and Rinks Center from the Twin Cities Chamber. They will be brief.
Thank you, sirs. Please state your name for the record. Mr. Flaherty.
My name is Joe Flaherty. I serve as a member of the Mounds View City Council and also a commissioner on the Economic Development Authority. I come to you as an elected official and a resident of the city of Mounds View for 21 years. Mounds View is a small community of 12,000 people in the northwest corner of Ramsey County. Following completion of a final connection between Trunk Highway 10 and I-35W in 1999, the vehicle traffic had gone from 60,000 cars to 79,000 vehicles per day. This generates significant noise, particularly for our LaPorte Meadows and our Long Lake Road residents. At current levels, it's difficult to have conversations inside and outside of the home. This level of noise prompted 291 residents to petition the city of Mounds View about those noise levels. City of Mounds View has been working with the Department of Transportation to extend the noise abatement wall that would address the problem affecting our citizens. MnDOT has programmed $300,000 in this year's budget for the sound wall extension on the south side of the highway. However, these resources only address the noise issue for our residents along Long Lake Road and do not address the issues for the LaPorte Meadows residents. The total cost of the project is estimated in excess of $850,000. The city of Mounds View is requesting an additional $400,000 in trunk highway funds for this project. Moreover, the noise wall extension costs in excess of $700,000 will be the responsibility of the city of Mounds View, or 20% of the project. This legislation addresses the quality of life issue for our residents in Mounds View. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I'm Dick Swanson, Blaine City Council, and I'm also president of the 35W Coalition.
Mr. Swanson.
In order to save time, I won't go into the coalition. You have a handout that explains a little bit about who we are and what our purpose is. But basically, this segment of I-35, Trunk Highway 10, has been studied forever. We've got the Trunk Highway 10 Interregional Corridor Study. We have a Highway I-35W Interregional Corridor Study. We've got a coalition traffic study. We've got coalition build-out studies. All these studies demonstrate that the I-35W Trunk Highway 10 WE segment is the key bottleneck in this link of the regional system that serves as the main portal from northern Minnesota into the Twin Cities. In fact, all you have to really do is look at your morning news every morning, where 35 95th is always the highlight player in the morning traffic report. Expansion of Highway 35 is not in the 2030 plan, only because the plan is fiscally constrained. However, MnDOT agrees that expansion is needed, and they are assigning a planner to work on this project. Individual interchanges are eligible under the management category, but without some idea of the ultimate design, interim investment decisions are being made in a vacuum. Lack of a plan for the future, either in timing or detail, for blending local access needs with regional mobility and safety leaves communities and counties and private investors in limbo. We really don't know how we can plan along this corridor until we know what the plan for the corridor is. We have businesses that want to expand, but they don't know if their expansion is going to be wiped out in 10, 15 years when the road is redone. Local roads are being overrun by regional traffic, but improvements need to be coordinated to ensure investments are not wasted. Preliminary analysis by MnDOT suggests that alternative solutions may require access trade-offs between city and development interest. In other words, some interchanges may have to be closed as this road actually goes forward. as cities and counties and private investors, we really need to know what the plan is so we can make reasonable expenditures on our own needs. Given that the expansion of Highway 35 north of 694 currently is expected to cost in excess of $1 billion, and is many years in the future, interim solutions to current congestion problems are urgently needed. Several bridges need to be replaced due to deteriorating conditions. Traffic management, shoulder use, and other congestion mitigation measures may offer temporary relief. But until we know what the plan is, or until there is a scope and a plan, nobody along that corridor can adequately plan. And that's really what we're asking, is for the funding to get a scoping study so we in local government and the private sector can know where our future is on the corridor. At the current time, we really can't make our good investments, and that's basically what our request is for. And there's information in the handout talking about the economic growth and development of the area, how many new residents are coming in, and how $4.6 billion in new tax base is being generated. And our numbers do not include anything north of Lionel Lake, so we're completely ignoring everything happening north of up in the Cambridge area and the Forest Lake, and we're ignoring all the new development along 610, which dead-ends into 35W. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Richard Santerre.
Mr. Santerre.
Great analogy, comparing my love for donuts and testifying before you today, but in lieu of time, I'll take that out of the plan. I am representing the Twin Cities North Chamber of Commerce today. I serve as the chairperson for the Public Affairs Committee. But unique to this particular situation, I am a former board member to the I-35 Corridor Coalition and former mayor to the City of Moundsview. The Twin Cities North Chamber is entirely supportive of this piece of legislation. We have 520 member organizations, which represents approximately 30,000 employees in 10 cities that we represent. Transportation funding has been identified as a priority for our chamber, and I know that does not distinguish us from anybody else before you today or any other day. However, as Senator Betzel pointed out, what's unique about this project and this request is that there was a revenue stream generated as part of the Medtronic development in the city of Moundsview, approximately $1.2 million that as of yet has not been identified for a certain project. It is these funds and this mechanism that we think is unique to our request today. The sound wall in Moundsview is many, many years in coming. The sound wall helps provide a balance between quality of life of our residents, transportation needs of a region, and the business community that looks to expand within our area. Without that sound wall, that balance is broken. Just a few years ago, or a decade or so, that road that is now Highway 10 carrying 79,000 plus cars per day was known as the County Road J extension and only carried a few thousand cars a day. The residents that are impacted by these cars have had their lives completely changed over the course of the last 10 years. As Councilmember Flaherty pointed out, in Moundsview, we strive to provide a quality of life for our residents. This sound wall helps us greatly in that end. It also helps the market-driven factors to the region where we have significant economic growth. The current Phase 1 and Phase 2 projects of the Medtronic development, along with the pending Stage 3 project, bring in approximately 4,000 jobs to the region, 8 to 10,000 daily commuter increases just from that one project alone in the next couple of years. In addition to the needs of the sound wall on State Highway 10, we have significant need for future planning in the 35W corridor. I just want to very quickly move from south in the corridor in Roseville to our northernmost region and tell you some of the things that are going on now, not even the items that have been put out there as possible future
plans. Very quickly, Mr. Santerre.
Roseville, significant plans for areas at 35 and County Road C, a massive residential commercial project in New Brighton called the Northwest Quadrant Redevelopment Project at 35 from 694 to Highway 96. The Arden Hills TCAP land, the single largest parcel of land in the entire metropolitan area, 500 acres, hundreds of jobs, hundreds of homes, hundreds of businesses set to take place. Three phases of Medtronic in Moundsview, a Pheasant Ridge project in Blaine, with the mixed-use development going on, and not to mention those items north of our service area. In summary, we support the need for a sound wall in the city of Moundsview. We support dedicating funds for study of future land use and future road use of the I-35 corridor coalition through the northern suburbs. I significantly appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Santerre. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, pretty questions.
We do want to get a happier say.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Betzold. As it relates to Subdivision 1, is this purely a funding issue, or is this jumping past MnDOT's standard for a sound wall? I know that MnDOT has a way of evaluating what area needs, what level of noise justifies a sound wall and not. Having been through that with one of the neighborhoods that's near the 494-35W interchange in my district, I'm familiar with that, and so I'm just curious if how this impacts MnDOT's current policy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, this is with redistricting. I picked up the city of Moundsview, and this is one of the first issues that they brought to me, and because it's been going on for many years. A letter that they wrote to me in 2003, and this is the city of Moundsview, not MnDOT, but they said that the MnDOT's policies provide noise abatement to areas that do not meet federal standards, but it does not apply to this segment because it was constructed prior to the adoption of that policy. They said MnDOT's argument is that they did not increase the capacity, only the volume, and therefore they don't feel compelled to address the noise issue. So there's a difference of opinion as to whether or not MnDOT is responsible or is not responsible for it. But this has been a longstanding issue. But I believe MnDOT can obviously state their own position, but that's my understanding of it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator
Betzold. I appreciate you raising the issue. I think there are a lot of communities that have legitimate concerns as it relates to their access to pull down what are very expensive projects that are impossible nearly for cities to do on their own. And so I hope as we continue to look at that, we can perhaps, affect the broader policy.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for my information, Senator Betzel, how much sound wall does $850,000 buy? Is that a mile, or how long is that?
3/4 of a mile.
3/4. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Betzold, or who can ever answer this question. I'm extremely familiar with this stretch of road, and I'm failing to find the connection between business and things. I mean, quality of life, I get that. But it seems to me that it's a low density in terms of housing and that a lot of the noise would be mitigated because it's a heavily wooded area. So I'm trying to find the connection here between how this, other than a quality of life, really affects the overall business atmosphere of the area.
Well, Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, subdivision 1 dealing with the noise barrier, it's not really a wooded area. I mean, there's a residential area that backs right up to Highway 10. I can assure you, I mean, I was door knocking that area last summer, and you can't even hear yourself think. This is late at night. I mean, it's loud, it's noisy. People cannot sell their homes that are there. And it's exacerbated because just right across the street, right across the road, is where the Medtronic buildings are now built, and it's just bouncing the loud traffic. It's loud enough, but it's coming back. When that was just vacant land, at least the noise was evened out. Now it's double that way, and it's it clearly is a residential area. It's not wooded. I've walked through it.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Betzold. I guess that's kind of making sense. When it was the golf course, it would dissipate the noise, yes. But now with the Medtronic buildings, we're getting
right.
A lot of...
Yeah. And the neighborhood is across the street from where the golf course was.
Right.
And that's the area we're talking about for the wall.
Thank you.
The south side of Highway 10, yes.
Any other questions from the committee? With that, we will lay over Senate File 8. For possible inclusion in a larger transportation bill.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, members.
And we will now take up two bills, Senate File 1265, Senator Sharon, and Senate File 97, Senator Day. And while people are coming up there, I have a small announcement to make here. Today is the last day for Bo Berenson, who is the second person to my left here. It's his last day as committee assistant. He's accepted a position with Senate Majority Research. We should acknowledge him for his good work. He will be replaced by committee assistant Kelly Russell. She is here and will be at the table beginning on Thursday. Thank you, Mr. Berenson.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
I have a problem that there's not a C in that name. I mean, there's not a B in that name.
In which? We'll put one in. Senator Sharon, Senate File 1265.
Thank you, Chair Carlson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Senator Kathy Sharon, and I'm here to present Senate File 1265, which appropriates $23 million to Trunk Highway 14 and County State Aid Highway 41 for an interchange on Highway 14 on the west edge of the city of North Mankato, which is in Nicollet County, and will reach to County Road 6, Nicollet County Road 6. It's a distance of about 2 miles. I think you have some materials to give you some visual images of this. Highway 14, as you probably have heard in the past, is a highway that runs the east-west corridor, southern part of the state, and connects several regional centers: Rochester, Owatonna, Waseca, Mankato, North Mankato, and New Ulm. This is the highway that's notorious for accidents and fatal crashes. From 2001 to 2005, there were 26 fatal crashes along Highway 14, and they took 33 lives, and 75% of these fatal accidents took place on the two-lane segments of this highway. The four-lane expansion of United States Highway 14 has been in process for nearly four decades, and while there has been some progress, the citizens really should not have to wait any longer. This project is a vital step in finishing the two-lane to four-lane upgrade of Highway 14 from North Mankato to New Ulm. This project is ready for final design and right-of-way acquisition, but it's been delayed till 2015 because of the lack of funding. With me, I have Mayor Gary Zelmer of North Mankato and Wendell Sandy, who is the city administrator for North Mankato, to discuss the importance of this project to their city and the surrounding areas. Mayor Zelmer is also on the Executive Committee of the United States Highway 14 Partnership. Also in the audience are Jim Swanson from the Minnesota Department of Transportation and Mike Wagner, who was the engineer from Nicollet County, in case there are any questions for them.
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Gary Zelmer. I'm the mayor of the city of North Mankato, and I understand the time barrier, so I'll make this very brief.
Thank you, Mr. Zelmer.
You have a handout in front of you that describes our project. The project itself is designed to make CASA 41 and the interchange with Highway 14 a safe interchange. Right now, it's a level grade in a highly developing area, both industrial to the north and residential to the south. The safety of this highway is a key for all of us in southern Minnesota, and this is our first push towards the west to increase it from the two-lane that it currently is to the four-lane that we need. It also will straighten out a very dangerous curve that is causing a lot of blockage as far as the visibility when it comes to exiting from 41 onto 14. This highway development and interchange is going to be the key for our new economic development area, which is going to be right to the north of it. We're currently, you can see portions of our industrial park, and that park now is filled, and we're looking at acquiring the next 90 acres, of which the city is already working with the county to develop the infrastructure in there to add that into our inventory of new land for our industrial park. This park, it will be 90 new acres. And in addition to it, the city of North Mankato has been to the legislature, both the House and the Senate now, to ask for permission for a 0.5% sales tax, which our voters have already approved at the last general election. $2.5 million of that 0.5% sales tax will go to the city's portion of producing this interchange. So we already have the approval of our citizens to go ahead and do this. This project has been on the radar screen for the Department of Transportation since 2006 when it was supposed to be completed. It's now at 2015, and it's going to slip to 2022 unless there's funding provided for us for these projects. With that, if there's any specific questions, I do have our city administrator here who could help answer any of the questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mayor Zeltner.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm studying this map, and I can find U.S. Highway 14 across the way, but for the life of me, I can't see 41 where you're going to have an interchange.
Which map are you looking at?
Is there? I don't see a number 41 anywhere on this map. Just the map.
That's the traffic count map. There's a brochure right in the middle which has all the map with the interchange on it. The 14 is marked right below the interchange right in the middle.
Where is this,
Senator Olson?
Chairman, sir, where is this on this larger map?
That is not on there right now. 41 is a county road catching to 40 or to 14. If you look at North Mankato, right approximately where the number 9600 is, that is where the interchange is, and 41 would be right off of that, right below that.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman and members, and Senator Murphy or Senator Langseth aren't here, so they've heard me talk about Highway 14 for like 16 years. So this is a wonderful project that Senator Sharon has, and I think all of us, and I have a Highway 14 bill in here also. I can tell you as members, I think today we've heard all these projects, and in all honesty, I can vote for all of them. So I hope that we can come up with some dollars to do that, and Highway 14 is a high priority. And there is the Highway 14 partnership, and Mayor Kuntz of Owatonna is a head of that. And maybe he'd like to say a couple words for both of the projects. They're for that.
Mayor Kuntz, please state your name for the record.
Committee Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Kuntz. I'm mayor of the city of Owatonna.
Mayor
I'm
Kuntz.
Also president of the Highway 14 Partnership. And I'm here in support of Senate File 97 to find some dollars for Highway 14 from Owatonna to Dodge Center. Highway 14 has been a two-lane highway. It was sections of it converted to four-lane. And as I was excited this summer when we were able to open from Janesville to Waseca, took that excitement back to our community, and the response to the community says we had that same excitement back in the 70s and the 80s when we first started these projects, and 40 years later this is still not complete, so we're still looking for that. Currently the EIS study is being done on the section from Owatonna to Dodge Center. That EIS study should be complete in 2009. We are hoping to be able to get the funds so we can start construction right after the EIS study is completed. We heard about the safety and the traffic numbers on Highway 14, but just to reemphasize, at the State Fair last year, Highway 14 was voted as one of the worst highways by the State Fair survey, and so that is standing out well within the state that Highway 14 needs to be upgraded and done. The traffic studies will increase on Highway 14 from Owatonna to Dodge Center, and currently they're at about 12,000 now, and by 2030 we'll be increasing to about 27,000. That's just more important that we get this highway completed, four lanes from New Ulm all the way over to Rochester. The Initiative Foundation in Southern Minnesota did a survey, and they have said that about 70% of the new business economic development will occur in Southern Minnesota will occur along Highway 14. It's just another reason that these funds get put into place. And the last thing I want to say is that we've got $65 million committed to take it from Waseca to Owatonna, and we need to make sure that stays in the packet so we don't lose that in July of 2008 as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kuntz.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Hiding here on the end. I'll be brief.
I appreciate the partnership that you've guys done on these. I think the city, county, and the state, that's good. On any of these projects, are there any federal dollars lined up at this point? Or
we have put packages together to the federal dollars and have requests in to Congressman Waltz, Senator Coleman, and Senator Klobuchar. So those are in process.
Senator Ortman. Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman and members, in that I've been in the minority my entire life, 16 years being here, I just think it's good that we all get to come here and tell everybody about the projects that are in the state, and then the MnDOT's got their priorities, and then we can change a few things, and I think overall it's been working relatively well. I mean, we have two great projects here. The question is, will we have money at the end of this session to do these things? And I think the more people that come up here, and if some people are saying, well, always just let MnDOT do it and don't, you know, put your oar in the water and, you know, stir it up a little bit and make the case for your project, it might not ever get done. So I think it's a little combination of both. But the big thing is money, and we might not have the opportunity to do all these things, but let's at least all give it a shot.
Senator Ortman. Senator Day.
Well, I'll visit with Senator Ortman some more, but MnDOT would have more projects if they knew we was giving them more money, so they probably would be more actively coming forward with a lot more projects also, but we'll visit.
Thank you. Senator Moore.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, when we talk about road projects or construction projects, it isn't necessarily one of those things where I think we plan this year and it's done this year. I think, you know, there are a lot of projects that, I mean, this is a long-term kind of investment sustained over time. And I think one of the problems that we're facing right now is that we're not able to identify, and I agree completely with Senator Day, predictable, reliable, stable sources of funding so that MnDOT can do their job to identify projects in a in a thoughtful, intentional kind of a manner. And then it doesn't alleviate the angst of people like myself or Senator Ortman, because we don't see and we can't rely on the fact that when they say, we'll get to you in 2 years, we don't trust that anymore. We don't believe that they'll get to us in 2 years, because when I came here 5 years ago, I was told that one of my projects will get to in 6 years, and now it's, you know, 14 years, right? We can't rely on that. And I think part of it is sort of what we've been talking about, which is let's give enough of a commitment for a sustained source of resource for them so that they can plan on it, rely on it, so that we can then rely on it and not feel like we have to fight with each other every session to see whose project gets put on top of the list, but that there's an orderly fashion to how we do our projects and that our citizens can rely on and trust when we say it'll be done in X number, in X year, that it will be done in that year.
Senator Ortman. Thank you, Senator Ortman. I think what we're going to do is we can put that discussion off to a financial discussion, and I think you're absolutely right. The last project here, I'll be 83 when it's done. So we have some discussions to do here. Any other pertinent policy questions? Well, thank you very much, Senators. With that, we will move... I'm sorry, we will not move, but we will lay over Senator Sharon's 1265 for possible inclusion in a larger transportation bill. And we will also forward Senate File 97, Senator Day's project for also inclusion in a larger transportation bill. Thank you very much. Senator Olsen. Senator Olsen has Senate File 441. And a reminder, Senator Olsen, to be as succinct as possible. And I understand you also have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would request to move the A1 amendment.
Senator Olsen moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign.
Mr. Chair, it's my pleasure today to be before you with some of the upstanding members of the North Branch community. I have the North Branch mayor on my right, Gloria Karski, and then our city engineer, Julie Dressel, on the left, and then from WSB, Rebecca Hayden is also here today. Just briefly, this project has been going on for a long time in the city of North Branch. They want to replace a bridge on State Highway 95 that goes over through 35. So it's a state highway over a federal highway, but the city has taken the lead on this, and they have really done their homework, and they've lined up the funding. Congressman Oberstar had, I believe, over $7 million in safety lieu. So we're at a package. I think we're about $6 million to wrap this thing up, and I will turn it over to the mayor at this point.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Gloria Karski. I'm mayor of North Branch, and I'd like to introduce to you our city engineer, Julie Dressel, who gives some opening comments.
Thank you.
Okay, very, very quickly, we did
hand out.
Ms. Dressel. Yes.
Yeah, Julie Dressel. We did hand out documents, so you do have this information in front of you. A couple of very short points. These improvements have been identified in MnDOT's 10-year work plan. The city has been working on the proposed project for more than 10 years and has secured municipal consent, MnDOT staff approved layout, and federal environmental documentation approval. Also, we are taking the lead on this state highway project, and it's ready to begin final design, and we can begin construction upon identification of the remaining state funding. And then the mayor will continue with a little information.
Please state your name for the record. Oh, you've already spoken. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mayor Karski.
Members of the committee, appreciate the ability to come before you and give you a little background on our bill here that we're hopeful that you will graciously consent to. North Branch is a growing suburb about 45 miles north of here. You probably have been through it many times. If you care to exit, it may take you a while to get over the bridge, I'll warn you, especially if you're going on a weekend holiday or any end of the business day. We have a need, and we've identified that need as a top goal of our city ever since I've been mayor. This is my third term as mayor. It has been the top priority. I've run on it as a campaign. That was my top need identified, and the city has endorsed that by our goal-setting sessions. So we have worked very hard. I've been to Washington 3 times to meet with Congressman Oberstar personally to get the federal funding for this bill, and we have been successful in doing that. We have over $12 million now from the federal government that's on the line, and all we need is $6 million from the state so that we can, together with the money that the county and the city will be putting forward, complete this project. So I hope you understand what's on the table here, because we have worked very hard to get the federal funding, which is the major part of our funding source. We have a need for many reasons. Highway 35 and Highway 95 are the main intersections in a regional area that ties a lot of our communities together at the junction of North Branch. We have a lot of traffic backup, both east-west and even off the freeway going north-south on the exit ramps, if you've ever gone up that way. And I personally have lived there all my life. When Congressman Oberstar was here, and I believe he addressed your committee a week or two ago, he talked about a baby carriage going over a bridge. Do you know what city he was talking about? It was our city, North Branch. I've seen it, and while I've lived there, I can't walk the bridge. I used to bike over it because I live on the west side, and our main shopping's on the east side. I can't do that. My kids couldn't do it, and my grandchildren can't either now. So we do need it for safety reasons, and I really want to stress that. The city has, like I say, $12.5 million in federal funding that's pending right now, and we've worked hard to get that. I truly hope that you can see to act favorably on this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mayor Karski. Senator Rolstein?
I think we're good.
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the language of this bill, and I'm pretty sure it has to go to judiciary.
Ouch.
Just kidding. No.
He's had bad luck. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Dibble.
I was just going to make a kind of a global comment, Mr. Chair, not necessarily to this particular project, though I am very familiar with how hard previously Commissioner Olsen worked on the transportation projects up in this area. But clearly, the need has been well articulated. I actually agree somewhat with Senator Day's earlier comments and Senator Ortman and even Senator Moi that, I don't know if we want to go to a system where we're establishing the list for MnDOT, but I'm glad that these bills are being brought forward because they clearly demonstrate the need and the fact that there's pent-up demand, clearly mobility and economic development and community development needs that transportation gets us that just isn't being fulfilled. I think we'll have some more conversation on Thursday, and we can really grapple with, what is the need? Clearly it's out there. How do we get to it?
Clearly there. Mayor Karski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to reiterate that this is on MnDOT's work plan. They've identified it as such. So we're working that angle, too.
Mayor Karski, for what year?
2014.
Thank
you.
But we want to build it before then.
Thank you. Well,
Mr. Chair, I don't know that any of these brought forward are not on MnDOT's list. It's just, you know, are they on the list for 30 years from now or 40 years from now or 10 years from now? And does that really mean 30 years from now in real life? So,
thank you. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, Engineer Dressel is going to make a final comment because she knows this stuff inside and out, believe me.
Okay.
Okay, we
Ms.
did
Dressel.
Want to
Go ahead.
We did want to, again, stress that we have obtained federal funding for the project. We don't want to lose that federal funding, and we need to identify the remaining state funding for the project. Again, it's critical that we don't lose the federal funding for this project. It has been identified by MnDOT. Some of the funds are there. We need the rest.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator Olsen. Any other questions? With that, we will lay over Senate File 441 for possible inclusion in a larger transportation bill. And we will go to Senate File 1071 with Senator Dibble.
Simple little bill, Mr. Chair.
Simple bill. You have about 12 minutes. Senator Dibble, you have a A1 amendment.
I'd like to move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Not sure which is the A1 amendment.
Oh, it's not. That's not yours.
Would you want to do that now?
It is your amendment.
Yes. Can I have a copy of the amendment, please? I'm not familiar with this amendment. Is this?
He's not familiar.
Well, Mr. Chair, the A1 is not being offered as an author's amendment necessarily, but I'm not opposed to the A1 amendment. So someone else would like to move it. So.
Senator Dahl has moved the A1 amendment.
Sorry.
And do not object to this amendment?
I do not object to the amendment. It's responsive to some of the concerns that have been articulated as folks have been around discussing this bill and concerns about whether or not if, in fact, someone receives a violation of this sort, whether or not it goes on their driver's record.
Okay. Any other comments on the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We'll try to go quickly. This is a heavily debated subject, so we have a very short amount of time for it. I'm sensitive to that. We'll try to be as fast as we can on our side making the case for this bill. But very quickly, what this bill seeks to do is to simply permit the implementation of the camera technology at intersections for the use of enforcing traffic signals. People may be familiar with, of course, the Minneapolis pilot project. Well, it wasn't intended to be a pilot project, but it turned out to be a pilot project in which this camera technology was implemented. Over the course of about 8 months, 25,000 violations were recorded, which is pretty amazing considering that these intersections were well signed, the cameras were very visible, and still 25,000 people ran the red lights. It gives you some indication of what level of violation is occurring out there just at regular stoplight intersections. It's I think people can tell you anecdotally, and others can tell you scientifically, that the level of public safety has decreased significantly in recent years with respect to regard for red lights. And so this bill would seek to correct some of the narrow findings in the court case that has been winding through the courts, that in which the courts found some technical flaws in our statutes. This will correct those to permit this program to be implemented. We have Councilmember Paul Ostra, who can take you through a little bit of the proposal, as well as Deputy Chief Sharon Levinsky, who can explain a little bit more about what we're thinking about here.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Dibble, for your leadership on this bill.
My name is Paul Ostrom. I'm a council member for the City of Minneapolis. I'm also joined here today by my colleague, council member Betsy Hodges, and, of course, Assistant Chief Levinsky will be also speaking to you. I come to you not just as a council member for the City of Minneapolis, but I'm also the chair of the Hennepin County Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee and also represent the City of Minneapolis on the League of Minnesota Cities. Both of those organizations have supported this bill because the Stop on Red initiative is a statewide public safety initiative. It proactively reduces accidents, it saves lives, it prevents injuries. Red light running places drivers, passengers, and pedestrians at great risk. And the use of these cameras is an effective, proven tool for law enforcement. We want to, at this point, show you three videos that are just examples of just how serious this issue is. And following that will be a video that will provide you with an overview of this program. I assure you the Stop on Red cameras are more efficient than our current technology here, but we'll get it going for you.
No.
Put the microphone right down by it.
Put the microphone down by it.
Where's the?
Or not.
Yeah, that's a
Is this a very long presentation?
Better with sound.
Okay. Well, in interest of time, we'll continue. The traffic safety program that we call Stop on Red uses sensor and camera technology to decrease the number of red light runners at 12 established intersections in the city of Minneapolis. It was launched in the summer of 2005, and in 8 months of operation, there were approximately 25,000 violations that were issued, 31% decrease in crashes at those intersections, and a 42% reduction of right-angle accidents at those intersections. And those right-angle accidents are the accidents most often attributed to red light running. What I would like to do at this point, then, would be to introduce Assistant Chief Levinsky, who will walk you through more of the details of the program.
Good afternoon, everyone. Just briefly
please,
about
please state
how
your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Sharon Levinsky. I'm Assistant Chief with Minneapolis Police.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Essentially, how does the question is, how does Stop on Red work at the intersections that we've identified through extensive accident records? We have sensors placed there for when a vehicle goes through a red light. That initiates the cameras to start up. The cameras will then take three different pictures in sequence, and it will also take about 12 seconds of video footage. These pictures and the video footage document that violation for us. After that, the system is really only triggered by someone who goes completely through a red light. If someone's turning right on red legally or is already in the intersection waiting for vehicles to come, that does not trigger the system at all. When there is a violation, there's a citation with the information, including some pictures of the violation, that is sent to the owner of that vehicle, as well as a way to go to a link to actually view the video footage of the vehicle that was registered to that person going through the red light. All of the intersections where we have Stop on Red are posted with signs, and not only posted with signs, but when we had the system up and running, we were very public about it. We had it on the internet. We put it in the newspaper so that folks really knew where those systems were up and running. Essentially, for us, in terms of our own processing and making sure that we've got a solid violation, we have an officer that was dedicated full-time to review each of the video footage to make sure we had the right vehicle, to make sure we had a violation before a citation would be issued. We have a contracted vendor that is responsible for installation and maintenance. And to underscore, the vendor does not receive a percentage of the ticket revenues and has no financial benefit linked to the number of tickets.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
So very quickly, the overview of the bill itself. It's based in concept on the practice when someone fails to yield to an emergency vehicle or someone fails to stop when a stop sign arm on a school bus is out, or similar to the Olsen bill from earlier this session, in which when a citation can be issued to the owner of a vehicle when there's failure to cooperate with an investigation of a hit and run. Very quickly, the bill does provide for some exceptions. You know, if the car was stolen, or if the car is a rented car, the rental agency is not cited, or if it can be documented that the car in fact had already been sold at the time. This does not constitute. This is not a violation that would be grounds for the revocation or the suspension of a driver's license. And with the amendment that just went on, of course, it wouldn't go on to the owner's driving record. It creates some standards in Section 4 for when this program is implemented. Only official traffic control devices can be used. It requires an officer to inspect and certify and issue the citation. It does make provision that the citation be sent in the mail. Requires that the Public Safety Department records note that this was a violation came from an automated device. And, of course, the signs are very important, but also an important fail-safe. You know, folks know that they're entering an intersection in which there's a camera that is going to catch them if they run that red light. And that's about the extent of the bill. There is some provisions for data privacy, use of the data by the vendor in question, subject to all the existing data practices laws, and there's a provision that this is the same kind of fine that you would get if you were cited by a cop caught in the act running a red light. And that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, I'm wondering if maybe we might need Department of Public Safety to tell us on this, but we spent a lot of time trying to get up and match the federal commercial driver's license, and I'm just wondering if your amendment would be considered masking of that commercial driver's record. So I'm a little concerned about that.
It doesn't show up on Chair and
Senator Dibble.
Senator Jungbauer. So it's a great question. I don't have the answer to it. Similar to the Dimler concerns for commercial driver's licenses.
Correct.
It's a great question. I don't have the answer to it.
Council Berezovsky would like to make a statement about that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not really sure of the answer, and I don't know if Ms. McCormick knows the answer, but it is an offense that goes against the registered owner of the vehicle, not necessarily against the driver. So I think an offense against the owner that doesn't go on the driving record logically wouldn't seem to be a masking problem.
Thank you.
Right, Mr. Chair, we have the Chief of Police from Burnsville who'd like to indicate his support. Chief Hawkins.
Please state your name for the record.
Bob Hawkins. I'm the Chief of the Burnsville Police Department. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I just wanted to make sure that folks were aware of this is much more than just an interest of the Minneapolis Police Department. This particular technology is something that Burnsville has been very interested in for a number of years, and our council is in unanimous support of this technology. And what I'd like to do is tell you specifically how we would put it to use in Burnsville. Most of you are probably aware of the makeup of Burnsville. County Road 42 is a main thoroughfare that runs east and west through Burnsville. Down off of County Road 42, we have the Burnsville Center and a very large retail corridor that's down there. During the high peaks, as far as Christmas and some of the other shopping seasons, traffic will start to back up to our border with Savage and Apple Valley. We're fortunate we have a four-person traffic unit that really gets after the traffic issues in town and tries to keep the roadways safe. Well, you can imagine, as a traffic officer, some places on County Road 42, we have 10 lanes of traffic. And just to identify the violator, traverse those lanes of traffic, get through the other motorists, and get that car pulled over can be quite a challenge in and of itself. And at times, we do work initiatives down there. And one of the things that inevitably happens is when we have motorists pulled over, the other folks that are driving by tend to focus a little bit too much on the squad cars and the vehicles they have pulled over, and will end up with an accident or two because they're not paying attention to their own driving. This technology would be wonderful for us because we identify the top 10 traffic locations in town. 7 or 8 of them each year are on County Road 42. With this technology, we could really get after those issues. Again, this is something we've been in support of for many years, hoping to get our hands on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chief Hawkins.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would just like to reemphasize, if I could, a 31% decrease in traffic accidents and just how significant that is. And I, on behalf of the City of Minneapolis, it's great to see the Burnsville police chief here. And I just want to reemphasize, this is a statewide public safety initiative. Before I was elected to the Minneapolis City Council, I was a municipal prosecutor for two cities, Blaine and Little Canada. And I even remember back then, and it's still true today, that after drunk driving, running the red lights is quite often the second leading cause of accidents on our roadways. So this is something that's true throughout the state, cities big and small. And I again want to reemphasize the support of the League of Minnesota Cities, the Metro Cities Association, AAA Minnesota, North Metro Mayors Association, Hennepin County Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, and only recently the St. Cloud City Council formally showed their support. But I will tell you that we have received all sorts of support from cities throughout the state that want to make sure they have this tool to make our roads safer.
Thank you, Councilmember Ostrom. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Hawkins, you're in my district. My daughter thought you were a hero of hers when she was going to high school there. I think you were the liaison officer back when she was going to high school. I think you were at her graduation party, so it's good to see you here. Where in Burnsville are you? I mean, you've got identified a certain number of locations. That besides, I know 42 is treacherous in that area, but is there more than just that area that you're looking at?
Chief Hawkins.
Yes, you know, obviously we have responsibility citywide, and again, we track the top 10 locations, and each year, usually about 7 or 8 of those are on County Road 42. In any other heavily traveled area, another example that I think you'd be familiar with would be Nicollet in the Burnsville Parkway. A fair amount of traffic goes through there. We have some issues there also. And with this technology, there's some versatility with it as far as you don't have to just put it on the one semaphore and leave it there forever. You can actually move those around. So as you start to help adjust some of the traffic behavior that's going on in some of those areas, it gets it to a more acceptable level. You can move it to some of those other locations. But it's like what's been mentioned. It's the right-angle accidents are the one that potentially are the most dangerous. And, of course, obviously those occur at the intersections.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, could I have one other follow-up? Just on the technology itself, I mean, we looked at the video and we saw that there's cameras out there with the sensors, and that didn't stop the accident. And as you're saying, people are drunk driving. They're driving through the red lights anyway. And you've had, if I look at the numbers that you gave me, 25,000 over 12 identified sites in a year. That's about 2,000 per site, approximately 6 per day of people going through red lights. After you've put this in, I mean, how is it the people who are in the area that, you know, most likely are going through these red lights, or I mean, how is it actually reducing actual traffic, you know, or accidents?
Through the chair, Senator, for us, I think it was, I think we were just really
Chief
very
Lubinsky.
Upfront about yes. about where these this technology was installed and what it was there for, which was to prevent exactly these right angle. Very dangerous traffic accidents. So I think once the word got out that the technology was there, it was up and running. As a matter of fact, that data was just for 8 months, so we had probably even more of those citations per day. And actually, when you think about it, in 8 months, we were able to reduce the right-angle accidents at 12 intersections by 42%, all the kind that you saw on there. So for us, I think it really was a way that we were able to reduce serious injury accidents just through the help of some pretty effective technology.
Thank you.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'd like to see if we could get Ms. McCormick up to talk about that masking, because as I'm looking at the AAA, where they want the penalties levied against the driver instead of the owner, and the ACLU has some concerns. I'm not sure, even though this bill would have to go to judiciary, I'm not sure how it's all going to shake out in the end, so I'd like a definitive answer on that masking and if it would affect federal funds or not, if it ends up getting levied against the driver as opposed to the vehicle.
And, yes, it will go to just judiciary, Senator. And please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. And, yes, I would agree with Ms. Berezovsky that this would be considered masking because the violation of the driver wouldn't be on the driving record, and Federal Motor Carrier considers that to be for every driver to be a potential commercial driver, and as a result there could be a loss of some federal highway funds. Or that there's a lot of discretion with them in terms of they could also not allow driver and vehicle services to either renew commercial driver's licenses or issue commercial driver's licenses, so that drivers would need to go to another state. And I think they would be they're, you know, another state that's in compliance with the regulations. Those are the regulations that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration keeps reminding us of in terms of any of the legislation that we send to them to look at. So,
thank you. Ms. Berezovsky, would you like to clarify your statement?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senators, I don't know the answer, and my supposition was that it would not be masking because it's a violation against the owner, not against the driver. But Ms. McCormick would obviously know the regulations better than I do.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, I think the concern would be that the driver would not receive the citation, though. Am I correct? Would there still be? That's what I wasn't clear on in looking at the bill, and from what I was behind the screen, so maybe I didn't hear you correctly. But the concern would be as long as the driver receives a citation for running the red light, that would be our concern. But if the violation goes against the vehicle owner, that would be the problem. And you're masking for if the vehicle owner is getting the citation and not the driver of the vehicle and they're running a red light, then that would be the issue with masking.
Senator Dibble, did you have a comment?
Just to be clear, the violation is mailed to the owner of the vehicle.
Ms. Berezovsky, more clarification.
Mr. Chair, on line 2.11, it says, this subdivision does not prohibit or limit the prosecution of the driver of a motor vehicle for the violation. So it doesn't stand in the way of apprehending the driver, charging the driver.
Thank you. Ms. McCormick.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Berezovsky and members of the committee, the concern would be if the intention would be to pursue the citation with the driver. And so that would be, I can certainly get an opinion from Federal Motor Carrier. I think the issue would be if we're letting drivers go through red lights and instead the vehicle owner is getting the citation and it's somebody else that's driving the car. But if that's the intention, is that the municipality would be trying to pursue citations with the driver. But I'll go back and I can get back to the committee with what Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration says they would think about the bill and give them the actual bill to look at.
Okay, that appears like there's some work to do on that to get that answer, and it will be going to the Judiciary Committee. So perhaps we can work on it before then. Senator Ortman.
Will the bill be sent back here so we can deal with this issue and address it? Because I think sending this bill to the Judiciary Committee, not having the information about masking, because that issue would not necessarily be within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee.
What they want to do. Send it to Judiciary. It's a policy bill. I don't know if there any urgency that has to pass because it's a policy bill because it's not subject to our deadline. So it would be that we could do it here if that's what the committee is to not subject this deadline is April 14th. So that time.
How do we move it?
Smoking in his car too. That'll be next. I guess.
Mr. Chair.
No. We're safe.
Mr. Chair.
How does the committee feel? Should we lay the bill over and then consider it again when we get those answers.
Chair, it's not uncommon for issues like this to be raised and for the author to make the commitment and the assurance to the committee that and these are issues appropriate to deal with in the Judiciary Committee and I think we can well handle that and I'll work with the chair of the Transportation Policy, you know, Senator Murphy, to see if it's important in his perspective to bring the bill back.
Mr. Chairman, did she make a motion?
Yeah, do.
It's not okay. Debatable, it's not Mr. Chairman. Yeah. We need to vote. He can lay out.
Need a motion.
I know. She made a motion, so we have to vote.
Table, which is an undebatable motion.
We need to vote on Senator Ortman's motion to lay it on the table. We
just vote.
We have to vote. So all those who favor laying it on the table, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No. 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 Division.
Division.
It hasn't ruled yet.
All those in favor, raise your hand. Seven nays. All those opposed to laying over? Nine. The motion does not carry. We have some more testifiers.
Mr. Chair.
Who's asking? Senator Fischbach.
Is it your intention to finish this bill today? Because, and I don't know if there's a committee coming in here afterwards, but I believe committee was scheduled till 2:45. It's almost 5 after 3, and by not laying it on the table, we.
The answer is yes. We want to finish.
So how late are we going to go, Mr. Chair?
Until we finish this one.
And you will, Mr. Chair, take all of the testimony and give them adequate time?
I believe we have two more testifiers.
Against? All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Dipple.
Mr. Chair, the additional testifiers are not my own, so.
Yeah, I believe we have Mr. Rich Neumeister and Mr. Howard Bass. Now, what I'd like to do is have you consider that this is going to the Judiciary Committee. So if some of your comments are more appropriate at that committee, I would appreciate you being real concise with your comments and a plan to talk to that committee also.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Day.
Well, first off, what you did is you overloaded the agenda. And now we get this real crucial bill, so I hope that everybody takes all the time they want, whether we have to stay here until 5 o'clock, because it's a pretty critical bill, and it deals with an awful lot of people in the state of Minnesota, thousands that could be getting these tickets. So. Let's just cool it, and we'll all stay here. And I got another bill to be heard, but I'm willing to stay a while. But let's not rush it now. We're already 20 minutes past. So,
Mr. Chairman, and to
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, and to that point, this whole day has been loaded with bills, and double booking of committees, and heavy agendas, and we're supposed to be the deliberative body. Remember that.
Senator Ortman.
This railroading things through without dealing with them in the appropriate committee is not what we're sitting around here for.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
All right. Why don't we lay this bill on the table?
Pardon me?
I don't know. I'll defer to Senator Murphy's staff here to see if we can take this up on Thursday. I don't know.
15 bills on Thursday.
This made Thursday worse.
Excuse me, just a moment. Members of the committee, I think what we'd like to do is honor the people that have come here to speak, and then following that, we can lay the bill over and then take it up at another time. Does that look like that might be reasonable?
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, we plan on taking the testimony and laying it over, so we won't be taking a vote until we get the other information regarding masking and the other questions that were asked.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ortman. Yes. Senators, we will be looking at a Friday 12:30 meeting to take this bill back up and finish the testimony, finish the discussion.
There are other committees meeting that time, too.
Mr. Chair, I
remember how many other people are at the
table there. Senator Rolston, I don't know how many other meetings are scheduled.
Mr. Chair, when is the next committee meeting? Both of these gentlemen can possibly come back and provide
the next committee meeting is Thursday, but it is already very scheduled, highly scheduled. So
okay, when does the chair envision we would take this bill up again?
12:30 on Friday.
12:30 on Friday.
That's going to be a problem for me.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, state your name for the record.
My name is Howard Bass. I am an ACLU of Minnesota Board of Directors member and volunteer attorney. I was the attorney and am the attorney in State versus Kuhlman, the Minneapolis Photocop case. I have a conflict. I've got to be in court in Apple Valley at 1:30 on Friday. If the committee, I could keep my remarks relatively brief, maybe 5 minutes. In deference to Senator Day, I'll try not to leave anything out. But I do think I have some observations I'd like to make for the committee that I think are important for it to consider, because I've learned a great deal over the past year and a half about photographic enforcement of law of traffic violations.
If you could be very succinct with your comments that are relative to this committee, and there it will be going to the Judicial Committee.
Could you move the mic as close as you can? Certainly. So we can hear you?
May I proceed? Great. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As I indicated, I want to share with you some things that I have learned over the past year and a half as I've been involved with the Kuhlman case, which challenged the validity of Minneapolis's photocop ordinance. The first thing that I've learned is that enabling legislation is required, the bill that's before you. That's what the Court of Appeals held, that's what the District Court held, and I have every reason to believe that's what the Supreme Court's going to hold based upon the research I've done concerning photographic enforcement of traffic violations in other jurisdictions. The constitutional issues which we raised in the Kuhlman case have never been decided, not by the District Court, not by the Court of Appeals, nor will they be decided by the Supreme Court. They're not at issue. But there are significant constitutional issues in that case involving things like the imposition of vicarious liability on owners for acts committed by people other than themselves who were driving the vehicles at the time of the red light violations. Standing the presumption of innocence on its head, presuming that the defendant is guilty of a crime and requiring the owner to prove their innocence and compelling the owner to testify in their own defense. None of those issues have been decided yet by the courts.
I want to take a couple of moments to express to you some very significant public policy concerns that I have about photographic traffic violation enforcement in general, and specific concerns I have about the bill that is before you at this time. The biggest public policy concern that I have and that I think you should think long and hard about is something that's known as surveillance creep. This is not the this may be the first request from the legislature to authorize the use of technology, specifically cameras, to assist in the enforcement of traffic violations, but I assure you it will not be the last. If you look around the country, according to USA Today, there are currently 22 states and the District of Columbia which permit red light cameras and or photo speed detection. At the oral argument before the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the attorney representing the city of Minneapolis candidly acknowledged when asked by Judge Randall whether the city would expand its efforts beyond red light violations to speed and other violations. She said that the city was considering doing that. They were just waiting for, no pun intended, the green light from the courts. This bill speaks only to red light violations, but I assure you it is a slippery slope. The amount of revenue that will be generated from photographic enforcement of red light violations will be a strong temptation to any municipality to come back to the legislature and request additional authorization for speed violations as well as other traffic violations. The question that you need to ask and actually answer is how much surveillance will we as a society accept in the 21st century? At what cost are we willing to surrender our privacy in the assumed interests of safety? My concern is that we don't start a slippery slope towards a 1984 Orwellian society where Big Brother government knows what we are doing at each and every moment that we are outside the privacy of our homes. An additional public policy concern that I have is promoting public safety. There is on the ACLU of Minnesota's two-page statement that was submitted to you a footnote on the second page to a congressional report that was issued in 2001. It's entitled "The Red Light Running Crisis, Is It Intentional?" I would encourage all of you to read it because basically what it says is that the photographic enforcement of red light violations is a scam that's being run by insurance companies and governments across the United States to raise revenue. And that according to the National Highway Traffic Association, engineers have determined that the more effective and less intrusive way to promote safety at intersections is by lengthening the time that lights are yellow. 80% of red light entries occur during the first second that the light is red. And there are corresponding data that demonstrates that if you increase the time that a light is yellow, you will decrease significantly, more significantly than through photographic enforcement, the number of cars that go through red lights. Another suggestion is to have an all-red interval where all lights are red to give traffic time to clear. The congressional report that's cited in the ACLU written testimony also speaks about statistical evidence demonstrating increased rear-end collisions by motorists who are slamming on their brakes to avoid getting ticketed by a photo cop. I also have significant policy concerns about the financial incentives, the millions and millions of dollars of revenue that can be made through photographic enforcement of traffic violations, and their particular susceptibility to manipulation by decreasing the amount of time that a light is yellow. And that's reflected in the congressional report as well. briefly with respect to my constitutional concerns about the specific bill that is before you. It establishes absolute vicarious liability. Unlike the Minneapolis ordinance, this particular bill conclusively presumes that the registered owner is guilty of running the red light. Unlike Minnesota Statute 169.20, which establishes vicarious liability on owners for failing to yield to emergency vehicles, there is no opportunity for the owner to come forward with evidence to prove their innocence, to demonstrate that they did not commit this offense. I'm also concerned about the potential for misdemeanor enhancement under Minnesota Statute 169.89. That statute allows petty misdemeanor traffic violations such as this to be prosecuted as misdemeanors, punishable by up to 90 days in jail and a fine of up to $1,000 if they occur under circumstances likely to endanger other people or their property, or if they are preceded by two moving violations within the preceding 12 months. What that means is if a registered owner who was not driving receives a photocop type ticket after having two speeding tickets within a 12-month period, that can be charged, even under the amendment as I read it, as a misdemeanor offense punishable by 90 days in jail and a fine of $1,000. You should also be aware that in Minneapolis's experiment, many of these cameras were placed in close proximity to restaurants and hotels that offered patrons valet parking, which means that you could take your spouse out to dinner, give the car to the valet, have an enjoyable dinner, and 3 weeks later in the mail, you get a photocop ticket. You have no idea who was driving the car at the time of the violation, and you could be held liable for that. With respect to the suggestions I would make, first and foremost, I would encourage you not to alter the essential elements of red light violations that have existed for decades in this state under our highway traffic code. If you insist on using cameras to enforce red light violations, I would suggest that you take the route that has been taken in numerous other states, and that is to require multiple high-resolution cameras. In many states, California, for example, there are four photographs that are taken. It's a more expensive system, but it's more reliable. It's more accurate because it enables you to identify who was driving at the time of the offense. Four photographs are taken in California. One is a close-up of the driver. That photograph is then used in court to prove the identity of the person who committed the violation. And in fact, in some states such as Oregon, the driver can submit what's called a certificate of innocence, and it's under oath, and a comparison is then made between the close-up photograph of the driver and the driver's photograph with the Department of Motor Vehicle Services. The bill before you requires only one camera. Minneapolis was using two. They weren't photographing the driver. They were photographing the vehicle and then a close-up on the license plate. So I would urge you, if you're going to go down this path that I strongly discourage you from going down, to require a system that photographs the driver and require the governmental unit that's prosecuting this to prove the identity of the driver, the person who ran the red light. Absent that, I would encourage you to treat this as a civil infraction like a parking ticket. That might alleviate a lot of the constitutional concerns. Prohibit it from being certified as a violation to the Department of Public Safety so it doesn't go on driving records, so it doesn't affect insurance rates of registered owners. Prohibit the possibility of driver's license suspension and revocation as the bill in its current form already does. And I would strongly encourage you to prohibit the possibility of misdemeanor enhancement pursuant to Minnesota Statute 169.89. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Newmaster.
I can come back on Friday, or would you rather I can continue?
I would like to hear what you have to say.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Neumeister. I am an advocate for privacy, civil liberties, and also open government. I've been around a long time, and I do it for free. What this bill does, and my specific recommendations for the bill to pass, if you're going to do that, are based on three principles. This compromises privacy and self-autonomy. Number two, it compromises fairness and due process. And number three, what it sets up is red light racketry by local municipalities. And I'll share that with you in specifics. First of all, we'll talk about numbers. City of Minneapolis had 26,000 tickets in their 8 months. This is from information I got. $1.2 million was the city's share. Under the formula, which they went under, is the split of like 70-30, whatever. The state got approximately a couple million, maybe a little bit less. So you're talking about, just in that 8 months, $3 million. Now, if you look at the current bill, and if you look on page 3, lines 3.5 and 3.6, as I read the bill, all fines are collected and will go to the local entity. It will not be that split, except where fees and surcharges provided by laws. My understanding is that fees and surcharges, basically the surcharge, for example, if I, for the law, you know, the law thing, an extra $5 or whatever. But that's how I read the law, and I think that needs some clarification. The other thing that, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Day pointed out, this is a statewide bill. And some of the experiences in some of the states that do some entities, what happens, and there's no standards for this. Minneapolis did some standards, and I like to see it in state statute. But some cities become, rather than the old speed traps, they become the light traps. So some towns have put it in, like the heavy traffic, out-of-towners come in, boom. And one of the things what happened, at least in some states, and one in the Atlanta Constitution pointed out, is $1.2 million was raised in one small town in Georgia. So at least one of the, some of the things that I'm going to suggest are some standards that you may want to do. I just want to throw out another figure. Albuquerque raised $5.2 million in 22 months. City of Washington, D.C. spent or raised $32 million. Now, the issue is that once the cameras come into play, the standard has been that the cities will then do more stand, get more cameras to raise more revenue. And now I believe in safety. I work for Metro Mobility for the last 24 years. I take vulnerable people around. I believe in safety. So, but I also believe, on the other hand, and I'm looking for balance. For the bill to succeed, I encourage the following. Senator Terwilliger did a similar bill 5 years ago. And one of the things he had is to make sure that the people who supply the cameras don't make out like bandits. So he had language in there and basically says that any contract with the private person for an operation, it's sort of like what Minneapolis did. They do a fee rather than, you know, an extra surcharge per ticket. So it's not based on how many citations does the company get. It's basically on a straight, you know, let's say it's $100,000, fine. You know, that's what they get. Another thing is that they had, in Terwilliger's bill of 5 years ago, they had a preponderance of the evidence, an affirmative defense for the defendant, so that I can say as a driver, look it, that wasn't me. And so it was recognized. And there's different styles of how you can do that. One is I would like to encourage a sunset of this bill after 3 to 5 years, that you come back and revisit it. I think it's important to put these standards in statute also, is that there be an annual report from any local entity that wants to do this kind of thing, talking about how much financial aspects there are to this. I think also there has to be a 30-day notice beforehand when as the cameras are rolling, so people do know that what's happening. A study by Morgan State indicated that the signs that are going out a lot in the different parts of the country, and I contend to believe the ones in Minneapolis, are sort of hidden. So you should have large signs, very clear and conspicuous. Albuquerque is looking at the issue of having possible flashing lights, you know, sort of like when you come to a light, it's going to change, boom, they're flashing. One of the other bones of contention is, what is the outright violation of the offense? As we all are drivers, sometimes you see the light, boom, you go over the crosswalk, maybe a little bit into the intersection, but not completely. Would that be a violation? There are no standards. So I'd like it to be very clear it has to be an outright violation. It's like some of the, not hopefully not in crashes, that what you saw here, but, you know, when it's right there, a red light. I think also you have to make sure that there's an engineering study. Any local entity that wants to do this, they have to have an engineering study on that corner, do the ratings, monkey around with the yellow lights. Are there other kinds of ways or things you can do before you install the red light cameras? One of the other things, and these are more of issues about now, you have photographic evidence. Photographic evidence is public, and it will be considered public. So one of the concerns I have, and as Minneapolis experience has been, they throw out some because they have an individual who makes some decisions about what should be done with some of those tickets. There will be evidence that there could be other possible violations that insurance folks or whatever may ask for that kind of evidence. I think it's unclear on some of the other things that you may want to do is take a look at some of the standards of how data is used, and that's an item that will be as part of the Judiciary Committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've raised some points. I know it's late. There are like several other points that I've shared. And as for those new members, but as the experienced members know of this august committee, I'm not someone that just comes in and walks off the street. I do have tons of research. I got every state in the union what they do. I got articles. I got research and all those kinds of things. So if any of you are interested in trying to improve the bill, which I think it needs some improving, I'm willing to work with any of you in that regards. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to thank you very much.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was excellent testimony on the part of both of those who came, and some good points were raised that I will take into serious consideration. Hopefully we'll have the opportunity to discuss in more detail before Friday. A couple of things that, unfortunately, I won't be able to rebut, and Mr. Brunswick here is writing fast and furious, so maybe I'll be able to talk to Mr. Brunswick before he files his story. I do know that at least my city people tell me that our city attorney did not say, and it's certainly not my intention, and no one has ever said to me, that we're looking for the, quote, green light to be able to enforce on additional sorts of traffic violations, regardless of what you think this might be opening the door to, and I respect people's views on that. That is not the city of Minneapolis's contention. They haven't said that publicly. They haven't said that to me, and it's not my intention as the bill's author to do that.
I can't hear you, Senator Dibble.
That it's not my intention to open this up for other purposes, and that's not the city of Minneapolis's purpose, nor have they said so in any other forum. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think we can just lay this bill on the table and, you know, work on some of the issues that I think were raised and have at it again on Friday.
Thank you.
Any other questions? What we're going to do is we're going to lay it on the table for, oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I got a quick comment and we'll get
Senator Day.
And Mr. Chairman, please don't think that we're being harsh on you because of the agenda and a lot of items on there, some of them go wild and whatever, but while I was sitting here, I was thinking, well, maybe what we could do is we could put them on them god-awful ramp meters, and we wouldn't have to give Minneapolis $3 million for the police. If we didn't, you know, probably save us $3 million, so I don't know.
Mr. Chair, if a nickel doesn't go to Minneapolis for this purpose, too, to Mr. Neumeister's point about racketeering, that's not the goal of this bill either. I don't care if a nickel doesn't go to Minneapolis.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to remind members that it might be very good to get here on time on Friday so that we can get started on time. If we want to get out on time, we got to get here on time. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.